All right, good morning, everybody. And welcome to the first regular session of this ARS conference. Just a preliminary remark, we know that the speakers are blocking the view in some areas, so if you would like to move any chair to anywhere, that's just fine. If you could just leave enough space for people to walk through, I sense we'll have a couple of latecomers. So our first session today is going to be on artists and repertoire jazz, especially jazz that is basically not widely commercially available in two distinct collections, the Bill Savory Collection and the Juma Sultan Archive, both collections that are currently being archived and brought ready to be premiered in front of the public. So our first presentation is on the legendary Bill Savory Collection, a treasure trove of unique 1930s broadcast recordings. And our two presenters are going to be Doug Pomeroy from Pomeroy Audio and Susan Schmidt-Horning from St. John's. And Susan, excuse me, is an assistant professor of history at St. John's University in New York. And she's currently finishing her first book, which I'm looking very forward to, Chasing Sound, Technology, Culture, and the Art of Studio Recording in America, which explores the interplay between technology, music, engineering, and business from really the birth of the recording industry up through the 1970s. Her work has also appeared in Music and Technology in the 20th Century and The Electric Guitar, A History of an American Icon, which is a book that I very much treasure. She's also a former musician and amateur recordist. She played with the 1970s rock band Chai Pig, which I highly recommend, by the way, and also performs with Email Special, a jazz group comprised of fellow historians who, like the Rock Bottom Remainders, basically play one gig a year. And Doug, probably familiar to many of you, he has 40 years of professional experience in audio and our audio restoration and recording. Spent quite a few years as staff engineer at Columbia Records in New York. Has also held engineering positions at Cadman Records, Museum of Broadcasting and Celebration Recording Studios, as well as doing work for the International Association of Jazz Record Collectors, Institute for Jazz Studies, Florentine Films, Metropolitan Opera. If I listed them all, we would be here all day. But I do want to mention that he does continue to do studio recordings with artists like Vince Giordano, and has worked on restorations for more than 300 reissues on many labels. And without further ado, I'm going to hand things over to him.
Well, I think you would leave that. I know you want to put the artist list on, right?
Oh,
okay.
Yeah. I stand corrected. I turn things over to Susan.
I want to say something now before I forget later. I want to thank Susan for help with this presentation and for flying out from New York to be here. Also thanks to Lauren Schoenberg, the executive director of the National Jazz Museum in Harlem, without whom there would be nothing to talk about this morning. Lauren is currently involved in developing plans for a new building for the museum to be built across the street from the Apollo Theater, and which is why he couldn't be here today. He's very deeply involved in that. I thought I would start by playing some very short music examples, and due to legal issues, I have been requested by the museum to talk over the music a little bit, talk about copyright. but I ask your indulgence. I will try to talk as little as possible. And I just want to say, these are my raw transfers with no audio restoration whatsoever. Kate, can we have track one?
The broadcast of the ceremonies attending the cornerstone laying of the Central Needle Trades High School, originally scheduled to be broadcast at this time, will be delayed until approximately 11:30.
We're going to start out by making a record of the voice on tin foil on the same crude machine that Thomas Edison demonstrated before President Hayes in Washington in 1878.
Mary had a little lamb. Its fleece was white as snow.
And now we're going to ask Mr. Summers, after I've screamed my lungs out, to reverse the cylinder
But what you will hear will be playing to you from the original recorder and phonograph. Here it is.
Mary had a little lamb. Its fleece was white as snow.
I guess that was me.
Well, I was up in Harlem and got a load of that new dance trucking.
Not that ever-loving trucking.
Why, yeah.
Well, go ahead, Miss Bailey. You sing it. We'll swing it.
Paul Whiteman with Mildred Bailey.
Listen, you rhythm rounders. Harlem is talking now. You know the truck bug got you, but you never knew just how.
No. Louis Jordan. Live broadcast. This is Duke Ellington. You have to recognize this alto saxophone. If you recognize this singer.
Just the old and white light for you. What a fool I used to be. Oh, now I've found two eyes, just a little bit bluer. And yes, I found a heart, just a little bit truer.
This voice.
What do they mean by the words packing the Supreme Court?
It's Django Reinhardt. I believe we have the only recording known as this
Fiesta Danceteria, the world's first self-service nightclub at the crossroads of the world, Broadway and 42nd Street in the heart of New York City, Mutual has brought you the music of Coleman Hawkins.
In person, singing the song that is driving swingsters crazy as they play it over and over again on their phonographs. It has a very strange and haunting effect on most people. It's got me. So let's see if it will get you. Billie Holiday and Strange Fruit.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit.
We have to move on.
This ought to be good.
You will recognize these guys.
My, they got me in a crack.
Supposed to talk over.
Say, this. My.
It's kind of criminal.
They got me in a crack.
Yeah.
If Blue or Jack don't take the next one, I'm gonna break my back.
Well, you better let me say,
well, you better go on and get it, well, son. I'm gonna grab me a picket off somebody's fence.
Oh, what kind of fence?
Listen to me, Mama. I'm gonna snatch me a picket off somebody's fence, and I'm gonna whip you over your big head until you learn some sense.
That's a killer.
Oh, mama, 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 where did you stay last night?
It's from one of the Martin Block jam sessions.
I ain't got nobody, nobody can for me. Why, I'm sad and lonely. Won't somebody take a chance with me? I sing love songs all of the time. If you say you see a baby girl of mine, I ain't got nobody. Nobody cares for me.
In attendance, a little meeting of famous door swings put on by Count Basie and his orchestra from the famous door in New York City. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System. WABC, New York.
Susan will continue.
Talk about not wanting to follow the opening act. All right, well, good morning. I'm really excited to be here to do my second ARSC conference. The other one was in 2004. I talked about Cleveland recording engineers, which is the beginning of my research for my book, which I don't need to introduce since Roberta did such a good job of that. But for my book and for my, which began as my dissertation, I conducted oral interviews with about 70 engineers, musicians, producers, independent studio owners, and others that were connected with studio work. And this is how I came to be acquainted with Bill Savory. How I got to Bill Savory was bizarre, because it was my mother's neighbor whose son was an executive with Sony Records who knew George Avakian and said, oh, you got to talk to George Avakian, and George Avakian got me in touch with Bill Savory. So I knew nothing, really, of this legendary collection of recordings until I was contacted by Lauren Schoenberg at the National Jazz Museum in Harlem last spring. Now, just to give you some background on Lauren, he's also a jazz saxophonist, a band leader, a longtime fan of Benny Goodman, for whom he went to work in 1980. And Lauren had heard about the Bill Savory disc collection for many years, and he was very familiar with the LPs of Goodman broadcasts, which Bill Savory had produced, the Air Check recordings. So anyway, he was in touch apparently with Bill's son, Eugene Savory, and Eugene is the one who said that I was the apparently the only living individual who was fairly knowledgeable about Bill's career. So who knew? So I interviewed Bill in 1997 at his home in Falls Church, Virginia, the Thanksgiving weekend. And I was mainly interested in his career and how he got started, his experience at Columbia Records. But based on my initial phone call to Bill, I wasn't sure what to expect, because he greeted me by saying, now, if this has anything to do with rock and roll changing music history, I don't want any part of this project. And I said, no, it's not like that at all. So I wasn't sure what I was getting myself into, but he really turned out to be one of the most charming and generous men I've ever met, going so far as to actually write me a letter of support for a NERIS grant, which I never got, but, you know, singing my praises. Anyway, he called me over the years to sort of, when he uncovered things from his trove of collections, and always saying, you know, when I get through this, I will get to more of it. And unfortunately, he never did, but fortunately, his son kept it all, you know, transferred it, and that's how we have all these recordings, which, thanks to Doug, you know, we can now hear. So to give you some background on Bill, and I'm just gonna advance this because I have a number of slides to show you. This is Bill on the right. He was a self-taught engineer. who began in the 1930s in some small studios where he first entered to actually make a recording of his piano playing. And there were a number of these studios in New York at the time. They were small, independent studios that used like turntables by Presto or Allied Recording Corporation. Audio entrepreneurs rented small two or three room suites in office buildings, recording programs and music off the air for artists, or recording live in their studio for song pluggers and advertising agencies, as well as singers or musicians who wanted to make demonstration records of their talents. Savory, who had embarked on what he described as a self-education regimen during the depths of the Depression by enrolling in a tutorial in electrical engineering, walked into one of these studios one day in the mid-1930s to make a piano demonstration record of his own. Having already attempted to build recording devices himself but frustrated by the results, Savory knew quite well about the technology. As he recalled, something in the studio wasn't working that day, so he fixed it, and promptly they asked him, and I quote, "Hey, can you do this on a regular basis?" And I said, "Well, sure, okay." So they gave me an hourly figure, and I came in there late at night on a scheduled basis when everything had calmed down and fixed the place. There was no restriction on how many of these places I could fix, so I went to all of them eventually on a regular maintenance schedule as well as occasional recordist on a fill-in basis. So this is really why we have these recordings, because he was doing this in the off time of the studio. Now, Savory found ample work during the 1930s doing this maintenance, and in 1938 he worked for G. Robert Vincent, doing these electronically, he worked on a system to electronically reproduce original wax cylinders for the National Vocarium, which was the collection that Vincent had at the studio which he established in Radio City. So this picture shows them in the process. You see Vincent, of course, looking at his watch, timing this transfer of the cylinder to the disc, and this next image is a close-up of this machine. Don't ask me to describe it. I got these images from a guy named Doug Collar, who did his dissertation on G. Robert Vincent. I don't know if anybody's ever heard of this, but it's a tremendous little book. I'm trying to get him to make it into a book because it's really fascinating. And I didn't know that, I knew that Savory had worked in the National Vocarium, but I didn't know about this connection with Vincent. So when I sort of was looking things up about him, I contacted Collar and said, "You wrote this dissertation. Did you ever hear him talk about Bill Savory?" And he said, "Oh, yeah." And so here's another image of them in the study of William Lyon Phelps in New Haven. And Phelps was an actor, orator, professor who taught the first course in the modern American novel, apparently. And I thought it was interesting that Phelps' own sentiments really remind me of Savory in a way. He talks about the happiest people are those who think the most interesting thoughts, who's, you know, spend their leisure time in mental development reading good books, good music, good company, and of course they bring happiness to others. But this is the quote that really reminds me of Bill: "If at first you don't succeed, find out if the loser gets anything." That's definitely Bill. So this is them in the studio actually doing the recordings. Vincent continued to do these voice recordings, and of course his, I don't know if any of you know of the National Voice Library, the Vincent Voice Library at Michigan State University, so that collection is there. And Vincent, I'll tell you that, you know, one of the quotes that Doug gave me from, or that I'm going to read to you from his email to me was that, he says, "I dug out a chapter about Bob that I wrote in the Vocarium studio. His memories of the detail about Savory, including his hiring Savory away from a guy named Ezekiel Rabinowitz, who had audio transcriptions." You know of this guy. Okay, he sounds like a real character. It says, "Raby was paying him $15 a week, but Bob gave Bill a $3 a week raise to become Vincent's right-hand man. Vincent remembers Savory climbing up a phone pole in the chilly New Jersey countryside while Vincent ran the equipment to record Goodman remotes." So Bob reports that Savory and he had many friendly disagreements about the musicians and radio personalities of the day. Bob would say, "So-and-so is a great guy," and Savory inevitably would say, "He stinks." Bob thought Savory was a genius, end quote. All right, and this is a picture of them loading that those recording machines into the back of a Ford V8 in the basement of the Radio City Music Hall. Okay, moving on, Savory's career. After he worked for at the National Vocarium, and that was in 1938, in 1940 he joined Columbia Recording Corporation and assisted in the operation and maintenance of the new facility in Chicago. So while he was there, he resumed his studies in physics at the University of Chicago. This letter of This letter of recommendation I found interesting. I have all of his, you know, effects in my apartment, actually. I'm trying to process these things. Doug's got all the music, and I've got all the stuff. But it's pretty interesting, some of the things I've come across. This letter of recommendation that was written by the commanding officer of a Marine bombing squadron is thanking Savory for his, quote, unselfish and invaluable services as electronic technician in charge of field installations in the PBJ aircraft. And I quote, considering the field conditions which he was forced to operate under and the lack of equipment and installation material, it was only through his ingenuity that the project was completed and evaluation tests were made with the gear, end quote. He goes on to note that Savory was also entered into various activities with the squadron, including everything from overhauling the squadron piano to rebuilding the movie projection machine. So this really gives you an idea of how, you know, multi-talented Savory was in doing anything musical and engineering-wise. And interestingly, this letter was addressed, this is 1945, and it was addressed not only to the commanding officer, but also to the Columbia Broadcasting System. So at that point, I think Savory was looking for maybe a bonus or a raise or a promotion. In any case, he joined Columbia Recording in 40, but went on in 1948 to work on the team led by William Bachman that completed the development of the LP record. And Savory was involved in making those transfers. Now, here's the a picture of George Avakian, John Hammond, Benny Goodman, and Savory at the release party for the Goodman Aircheck recordings in 1953. And this took place at Columbia's 30th Street Studios. Which Bill was very much involved in sort of tweaking the acoustics of the studio in the early days, bringing the massive reverberation time of it into focus, as he put it. He, in process of doing that, he built these parabolic reflectors that were used by Johnny Ray to sort of bounce his voice back and forth, but also routed through this reverberation chamber. And Ray apparently loved it, but others, as he said, you know, it wasn't so easy to adjust to this playing with these things. Some people wanted to back off of the reflectors, and that's why he put them on wheels. He says, it did the job quite well. Some of the people thought it was strange. One guy made the remark, a string player. He said, this is going to make me go home and practice a hell of a lot because I can hear all my mistakes. So then Savory went on after, I'm not sure the circumstances of his leaving Columbia, but he went on to become chief engineer at Angel Records, EMI, which had just been bought, you know, they just bought Capitol, in 1953. And I don't know exactly about this image, but it looks to me like this was an A-B kind of listening thing that he was doing. I'm pretty sure that's him sitting there, and I think this must have been when he worked for EMI, Angel. He also was involved in building the stereo control room at the Capitol Studios in, you know, the new Capitol Tower, which had just been finished at the advent of stereo, but as a mono studio. It was like state of the art, the first one built from the ground up. And he said, you know, they were all sort of against stereo, and he really had to sort of convince people that stereo was the coming thing. So after he left Capitol, he then went on to be part of the Berlin call-up as a naval reserve officer. This was during the Cuban Missile Crisis when there was a little bit of nervousness about that. So after that, of course, that just lasted for a few months. And he went on to work for Mattel. And now this, another thing, and I guess you can't see this very well. I don't know if I can darken it, but I'll describe what you're looking at here. This is a project sheet for the Mattel talking doll, the Dishonest John hand puppet. I don't know if any of you recall these dolls, but this little round thing up there, that is actually a little record that was attached to this sheet. And with grooves and everything. I mean, I didn't know that that's the way they worked. I thought, you know, pulled a string and something in there went, you know, yeah, 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 I'm Dishonest John. Or what was the other one? I'm an old meanie and I love it. This sounds like the kind of thing that Bill was involved in. And indeed, he was very much, sorry? They're vertical. They're vertical, yeah, yeah, yeah. Actually, Gene was telling me that he had one and that's the way they worked. Anyway, and this is a planning thing, you know, which I actually scanned separately and they married them up and I can't believe I did that. But, you know, he was involved in the design of this thing. So again, moving on to a different kind of life from having, you know, recorded Benny Goodman. And so maybe this is what happened to him after working for Mattel. I don't know, but this image which Gene sent to me and which I included in the obituary I wrote for the Audio Engineering Society Journal, I don't know when this is from, but it really says a lot about Bill, too. He was just a quirky kind of interesting guy. Anyway, I've gone through this very quickly, and I just want to, you know, move on. But he then went on in 1980 to found Lyricon Records, which was a project he was very much involved in at the end of his life. And I don't think he finished at all what he was trying to do, which was to bring some of Helen's recordings back, you know, into production through CDs. He was a charter member of the Audio Engineering Society, the Sapphire Club, even before that, the IEEE, and the American Institute of Physics. I think that's all I've got. I'm just going to stop talking now and let Doug do the talking. So I think that's okay. The end of my slides. Oh, yeah, this is one thing that I think was the one you sent me and I couldn't open. And again, I guess it's just too bright. I'm sorry about that. But this is from Radio Recording Studio, which is actually one of the New York studios, not Radio Recorders, but one of those little ones in New York at 1619 Broadway. And this is the Benny Goodman Let's Dance radio show on WEAF in Saturday, March 23rd, 1935. Yeah. So we're back okay. to
you,
that
you
era.
Got my slides
I'm going to get your slides going right
okay.
there.
All right, we have to move quickly. Yes, there they are. Good. Lauren had heard about the Bill Savory disc collection for many years, and he was familiar with these LPs, which Bill Savory had produced for Columbia and then MGM from his discs. It took Lauren 24 years to track down the collection. He had written to Bill Savory many times, but Savory was reticent and resisted making any decision about what was going to happen to his discs. When Bill died on February the 11th, 2004, which coincidentally is the 157th anniversary of Edison's birth, Lauren started writing to Bill's son, Gene, who had the discs in Malta, Illinois, and eventually a deal was worked out for purchase of the entire collection by the National Jazz Museum in Harlem. That's Lauren on the right, and that's Gene Savory holding a sign for Columbia Records as a joke. in April of 2010, Lauren went with two helpers to Malta, Illinois to catalog the collection and pack up the discs. That took an entire week. The discs were then transported in a rented truck to a secure storage facility in New York City, and they are delivered from there a few boxes at a time to my studio in Brooklyn. Lauren called me from the truck driving from Illinois to New York and asked if I would transfer the discs. Well, I was flattered, of course, but I said, no. I said, I it's too big. I don't want to get into that. I'm an old man. Forget it. But he insisted on coming to my studio and playing a Count Basie raw aluminum disc that nobody in the world has a copy of with a great Lester Young solo. So I said, okay, I'll do it.
This is a little different from Lauren's account of it.
But he had cataloged approximately 1,000 discs in Gene Savory's living room, and he created an Excel worksheet pretty much by the seat of his pants, on his laptop, entering information which Savory had written on the sleeves and or scratched into the discs. And fortunately, Savory was very good about dating his discs. I can't tell you how important that was. So he knew that what he was doing was of some possible historical interest. The discs are of varying sizes, from 8.5 to 17.5 inches, some recorded at 33 1/3, some at 78, some on one side only, some on both sides, some with only a few minutes of music, others with more than half an hour. So before actually playing the discs, it was impossible even to estimate the total amount of music, which I did in my studio. I cleaned and re-sleeved all the discs, which, believe it or not, took longer than playing the discs. Because many of them were in very bad shape. This one is not in particularly bad shape. Many of them were much worse than that. But that's just the usual deposit on the surface of a lacquer. This is a this is again a nice shiny lacquer with a MusicCraft label, which I'd never seen before. Anyway, the collection, you know, an overview of the collection, it's a hodgepodge. In addition to the jazz broadcasts, it includes some LPs, some Shellac 78s, dubs of Shellac 78s, V-Disc Studio Master lacquers from the 40s when he knew Tony Janik and was probably involved in recording for V-Disc, 16-inch transcriptions, you got that green label thing, yeah. I never saw one of those before, but talks by FDR and other news broadcasts, studio microphone frequency response tests, recordings of Savory's piano playing and his amateur jazz band, recordings of various phone calls, including his girlfriend Blondie, even his own wedding he recorded. I don't know how he managed to do that, but there it is. I guess you can't make out a word, but it's there. Jazz-related music is found on roughly half of the 1,000 discs, at least as far as we know. Of course, we don't absolutely know until we play them. That Duke Ellington Django disc was unmarked, completely unmarked, 16-inch disc. But by playing it, we found what it was. A lot of the material is by Benny Goodman because Savory knew Benny Goodman, loved Benny Goodman's band, and, as I say, married Benny's singer, Helen Ward. The discs he recorded between 36 and 39 are all aluminum, either lacquer-coated or raw, uncoated aluminum. The lacquer is badly deteriorated in many cases, and cleaning those discs is a major task. I don't have to tell any of you who have used mineral spirits. I have to use a vapor mask, and it's arduous work. Many of the uncoated discs have areas of severe corrosion. You'll see that spot over there on the right, presumably the result of exposure to water. In those areas, the recorded grooves no longer exist, unfortunately. You can't just scrape that stuff off. The groove is gone. So no complete restoration of the audio will ever be possible. However, all discs were transferred, regardless of condition. We now estimate that about a third of the discs are in excellent condition, one third in really bad condition, and the rest somewhere in between. The good news is that Savory took these copies home with him and didn't play them. There's virtually no sign of record wear on any of his discs. And his son Gene was afraid to play them because his father said, no, those lacquers are fragile. So we're lucky in that regard. Some of the things, they really sound like they were recorded yesterday. The old sleeves are covered with mold and mildew. Well, that's my cellar there where I put them because they are poisonous. I have to use a disinfectant spray and wear a mask when dealing with those. Nothing was discarded. The old sleeves were saved in plastic bags and the discs were placed in, after cleaning, were placed in new acid-free sleeves. The Excel worksheet, which you won't be able to see, oh, that's disappointing.
It's so bright.
Yeah, it's too bad. I'm sorry. Anyway.
I can see it.
Can see it, yeah. It is an Excel worksheet. And it shows, you know, each disc has a number. And I think if Lauren were to have done it over again, he might have found a way to indicate one side of the disc and the other. Because if you just have one number for both sides of the disc, you then have to figure out how you're going to convey that. But that's the first item, then the date, then the artist and artist's name. You don't have to put them all in. Then the titles, and then a category for the speed. Well, we'll get to that in a second. My worksheets, again, you won't be able to see that either, I'm so sorry, but my transfer sheets, I send copies to Lauren, and I also include in the Excel worksheet the size of the stylus I used, the speed that I played, and the percent of any pitch correction, because as I'll mention in a minute, I think that's very important. The majority of the sleeves were copied from other discs. So there were two turntables involved, meaning there were two opportunities for the pitch to have gotten altered. And some of the music is very, very severely off pitch. Figuring out the correct musical keys is fairly simple given the type of music that Savory recorded. pop music and jazz. I personally feel it is incumbent upon an engineer to check the pitch and correct it if necessary when making an archival transfer to avoid unnecessary processing later on. All my transfers were digitized as 24-bit 96K WAV files onto two external hard drives plus two DVDs, one set going to the museum, the other staying in my studio, and tape backups in LTO form are going to be made, they haven't been made yet, but they will be made from my hard drives. Regular CDs for playing at the museum, the so-called circulation copies, were down-converted from the 2496 files. All my transfers were made in stereo to allow for channel editing when restoration work is finally undertaken. Because Savory recorded all his discs in a professional transcription studio, Audioscriptions on 47th Street, do we have that label? Yeah, there it is. What he did was he'd take these labels and he'd turn them over and then type his information and glue the labels on his disc. And of course, they all fall off, so I have to glue them all back on. But there is a high degree of consistency because the studio equipment was very good and they stuck with what worked. For instance, virtually all the lacquers play best with a 2.5 mil truncated elliptical stylus. So that greatly simplified my work. I would start out and I have a way of testing how well the stylus fits the groove, which I've explained in past ARSC conferences, so I won't go into that. But what is surprising is that the uncoated aluminum discs also play best with a 2.5 mil truncated elliptical. And that might have been intentional. I don't know how much control they had over that, but there is an embosser. These aluminum discs were not cut, they were embossed, and I'm told by people who know more about this than I do that something was added to the aluminum when it was manufactured, paraffin or wax, in order to make it soft enough to be embossed. But you can see that heavy weight out there, and Nick Berg tells me that on the professional models that the weight is even bigger. You can imagine. I mean, it's extraordinary that this worked. I mean, they can sound quite good. Okay, I'm almost done. Where did Savory get the discs he used? The vast majority were partially recorded discs on which there was still some space available on one or both sides. The studio where he worked would have had a scrap heap somewhere, with one or whole blank side discs and other discs which were started and then unavoidably cut off, like the very first musical example I played. And he would then look at the amount of available space on the disc and he would time the music from the disc he wanted to copy, so he would know then what speed to record, how many lines per inch to emboss or cut, and this was the way he was able to get the music that he wanted. There are, of course, occasionally incomplete performances for reasons we'll never know. But there's a lot that is complete, and it's because he could foresee how long he needed. The restoration work will be started only after the archival transfers have been made, and those are not yet finished. Since I started in June of 2010, I've recorded 88 CDs with an average duration of 77 minutes, which works out to 113 hours of music. Meanwhile, the CDs of my transfers, without any noise removed, are being played in the museum for anybody who wants to come and listen, and a few excerpts were also posted on the New York Times, CBS Evening News, and BBC websites. Eventually, we hope that there will be a commercial release of some of the best of the music. The legal hurdles are, of course, formidable, and the museum has legal advice, which is why they're being so cautious. But whatever company takes this project on, I hope they have a lot of lawyers working for them. Speaking of restoration, get track two ready, please. Lauren asked me for a couple demos to show what sort of improvements might be expected. So I will end with some extremely short examples of before and after. Track two.
China Boy.
Hey.
is Cab Calloway. This is Gene Krupa. With probably Joe Marsala on the planet. We don't know. Now a little bit of Art Tatum. Thank you.
Okay. I'm not sure how I should disconnect this. Can I just pull it out? Can I just disconnect this for him to put his... All right, and while we are switching over technologies, are there any questions? Yes, back.
How I cleaned them? Well, it's not rocket science. I got some of the Disc Doctor's Miracle Cleaner, which is very expensive. But if the oxidized material on the surface is not very thick, the Disc Doctor will take it off. I mean, you can use other things too, ammonia. There's other things that work, but I use that because I think it's safe, and I have a big bottle of it. If there's a lot of this the fatty acids on the surface, I will use mineral spirits, you know, wearing a mask. And sometimes the deterioration is so severe that I actually have to do that twice. But at a certain point, you know, you reach the diminishing returns and it doesn't get any better. But a lot of the lacquer is what I call blistered. It just, you know, the surface is no longer flat. So you've got some vertical modulation, which is easy to get rid of if you tune the mono mix as carefully as I do. But there's also some lateral when you go over those, it looks like it has the measles or chicken pox or something. And you know, you just get the record as clean as you possibly can and then play it. As I say, the pitch correction, I have a whole set of chromatic tuning forks and also an electronic keyboard. And I don't have perfect pitch, but discrimination is something that can be learned. I mean, you can actually get better at it if you do it long enough. And so I spend a lot of time on that because as long as I'm going to mess with it, I want to feel confident that I've really made an improvement and that I got it right.
I see. Michael, do you have a question?
Can you rephrase that question?
Yeah, in other words, this is the best. These are remote pickups.
They're what?
Remote pickups.
Yeah, but the scratch wouldn't have been.
No, I'm talking about the original sound.
Yeah, no, they're not all remotes. I mean, all of the Martin Block programs were studio, and that's why that some of the ones I played sound as good as they did. Those were studio recordings. But 90% of the Benny Goodman is either Let's Dance from 34 and 35 or the Camel Caravan, which went on for years. And we have, we're not done with it yet, but we probably have every single Goodman broadcast because Savory really loved that band and he knew Benny. And he got some of, when Benny died, he went to Benny's house and had some kind of an arrangement where he could take things that he had loaned to Benny and perhaps things that he wanted to take home for safekeeping. I mean, as you know, the rest of Benny's stuff went to Yale.
We have time for one more question. Okay.
Percentage for line checks versus air checks, I think, is what Mike is really asking.
Oh, okay. I didn't get the question. Well, I would say they are 99% line.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you know, which is why they sound that good. Yeah. As far as we know, I mean, this is not documented anywhere, but there are telltale signs of what is a dub. In fact, I was going to include a slide on how to tell when something's a dub. There are a number of things that give it away.
Do we know about the existence of the originals of some of these? Can you check the NBC collection and elaborate on it?
Yeah, sure. I'm sure if we compared notes, there's a lot of stuff at LOC that Savory has.
Turned up yet, you know, we now.
Yeah. It remains to be figured out. Yeah.
And I'm sure if there are other questions that Doug and Susan would be happy to answer those after the session.